Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The U.S. averted default by passing a debt ceiling bill, but the stock market plummeted hard. Here's economist David Kotok.
There's very serious stuff going on, and people should be concerned. That's different than panic.
Stopgap funding puts the Federal Aviation Administration back to work. Here's Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood.
I'm thrilled. I really am. I'm thrilled for these hardworking people right in the middle of the construction season. They're going back to work Monday and what they want to do.
And Egypt's former president, Hosni Mubarak, was wheeled to court on a hospital gurney on trial for the death of protesters.
These newspaper headlines say it all. Day of accountability. Historic day. This is the first time that an Arab leader has been deposed and tried by his own people.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Bill McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News, Eleanor Clift of Newsweek and the Daily Beast, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What are you watching this week? The stock markets, global markets, job markets? Are you relieved by the debt ceiling deal or worried about it? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us today from Washington is William McKenzie. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning editor. Editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News, and he moderates the Texas Faith and Education Front blog. Bill, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Jackie.
And also joining us from Washington is journalist Eleanor Clift, contributing editor to Newsweek and the Daily Beast. Eleanor, nice to have you back.
Glad to be with you, Jackie.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Jackie, Eleanor, and Bill.
Hi.
Wow.
Well, what a week, everybody. I mean, even the debt ceiling debate seems like it was a long time ago, and I just keep thinking from pillar to post. Eleanor, let's start with you. A little bit of good news, at least, crossed this morning, that the job decline is slightly up from 9.2% to 9.1%, so a bit of an increase, 117,000 new jobs. Is that good news for the president?
Well, yes, in this environment, yes. I think the predictions were a growth rate of jobs of about 80,000, 85,000. The fact that it came in above that, I think, made investors and politicians believe that the plunge in the stock market yesterday is not U.S. specific, that we've caught a bit of the European flu, but our own economy, while it's sluggish, may not be crashing. I think the fact that the jobs numbers looked relatively good gives people a little bit of a breathing room. But in a way, what's missing in Washington is a sense of urgency. And I think the jobs numbers, in that sense, serve to allow the Congress to go off on its vacation, when instead I think you American people are looking to Washington to really get this right and figure out what they can do about creating jobs.
Well, speaking of Washington, Bill McKenzie, where I understand you're mm-hmm. on a holiday there from Texas, or
that's right.
Not reporting, but you know, in the thick of it, obviously, and I know
and you can't ignore it if you're here.
No more than the heat. I want to refer to in poll taken by the New York Times and CBS News, a record 82% of Americans now disapprove of the way Congress is handling its job, and that is the lowest number since they began asking that question back in 1977.
Really striking. And you got to think that members of Congress from both parties are going to be hearing a lot about this now that they're back in their districts, senators as well. That the public's really fed up. And I think there is a serious disconnect between Washington and the public on this thing, on both sides. I think the public was much more willing, by and large, to go with a bigger deal, a grand bargain that would include serious spending cuts, entitlement changes, painful as those may be, as well as a mixture of tax revenues, a 75-25 split between spending cuts and tax reforms. You know, Washington just wasn't willing to buy into that, largely because the pressure brought by the Tea Party at first, which was a good thing. And I think that's lost in this debate at this point. The Tea Party put pressure on Congress to act. Unfortunately, the Tea Party doesn't have compromise in its DNA, and that's where we are, and we're stuck.
Jack, it makes me think if I help someone drive, I don't want to just grab the wheel. I mean, what do you think about the Tea Party influence right now? In this same poll that I cited a moment ago from New York Times CBS, it said that the public read on the Tea Party was a lot more negative than it had been in mid-April, up to 40% from 26%, I think it was. Jack Beatty?
Yes, hi. I'm sorry we were cut off there for a second.
Oh, I was asking you whether or not you think the public holds the Tea Party to blame, and I was citing a New York Times account that suggests that certainly their influence has not been favorably regarded by everyone.
No, it seems to be that it's plummeting. On the other hand, I think you have to say that the 2010 election now, the Tea Party election, appears to be have been historic. As Bill said, the Tea Party changed things fundamentally. And essentially their agenda of putting the deficit and debt before growth, is the primary focus of attention. The president has now bought into that. That's now part of law. That is going to be governing us through these deals for years. And so perhaps they're waning in popularity, but they have really, in large measure, won.
Eleanor, you wrote a column about House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi this week. I just want to play a clip before I ask you about this. She told MSNBC's Andrea Mitchell on Wednesday that despite her displeasure with the debt deal, it's time to move forward.
It's a bad deal, but it's a done deal, and it's time for us to move on. It's the basis on which we are going to proceed, and we have to get on with it. We've got to go to the table, do the best we can in a balanced, bipartisan way to create jobs, reduce the deficit, and take us into the future.
So she had a group of a few journalists in, and you were one of them, and you described her as stunned by the deal, stunned by what had happened, but determined to put the emphasis back on jobs. I mean, is that possible?
Yes. Well, she has five children, and she said when they were young, everybody was always fighting in the car, and when they would leave San Francisco and go over one of the big bridges, they had a family thing where they would say, throw it over the bridge, and we're on to the next place. And that's what she's saying now. She said the more focus on the debt and the debt deficit and the process and who's going to get named to this super committee, she said that plays into Republican hands, and that she believes that the politicians really have to get back to where the people are, and that is the focus on jobs. Problem is that the president has several initiatives before the Congress, infrastructure, bank, trade deals, but they're being blocked on Capitol Hill for a variety of reasons, not just by the Tea Party. The Republican Republicans haven't really allowed this president to act either. So I would just hope that the bad numbers that we're seeing would inject some urgency into this debate and perhaps break down some of the opposition, the political opposition on Capitol Hill.
But Bill McKibben of the Dallas Morning News, Congress is away for 5 weeks, and certainly the wild ride on the stock market, a downward ride, has perhaps taken attention off of something that everyone was thinking about just 24 hours ago, and who's going to be on that super committee.
Well, and it may have for the moment, but that super committee is really a very important thing. It's much more than just an inside Washington deal, because who sits on that committee will determine whether we get this grand bargain that we keep hearing so much about, and I was kind of explaining a second ago, because those people are the ones who are going to have – they're going to have a big say over what goes into the next set of cuts that will be coming forward in this 18-month plan, basically, that they have. And so, you know, if you're in the investment world and you're looking to see what Washington does, you know, that's going to be really instructive and informative as to, you know, how serious they are about doing it. I will say one thing about this debt deal, and I, too, am completely on board. It's incrementalism. You know, we got it done. At least something happened. We didn't go default. All that's better. But if you look at this, and I'm probably going to blow the numbers, I think it's $2.6 trillion if it all works out over time. And I was picking up the Washington Post and reading it this week thinking, you know, I don't really remember much in the past about us being able to go forward and cut about $2 trillion out of the deficit over a 10-year period. And so that in itself, these are not small potatoes. The problem is our debt is so big at $14 trillion. This is just, barely entry into the game.
But it has been suggested that perhaps some of this legislation might be modified. However, Jack, as we know, if they don't come up with something, what is it, by November, day after Thanksgiving, then this other round of cuts takes place? Sometime before Christmas.
Yes, you get the dreaded sequestration. it sounds...
I dread the word.
Yes, you can see a new movie, the sequestration. And it's scary. And yesterday, Secretary of Defense Panetta, made a very strong case, and we're going to hear more and more of it, that the Defense Department simply can't afford, the United States can't defend itself. If those cuts, those automatic cuts, go into effect. And his argument is going to be echoed by a multi-million-dollar push by defense contractors to defend every last program in the government. And it's that the Defense Department
every last
funds.
Defense program.
Yes.
Yeah.
And right. And I don't understand on the deal. I guess I do understand. The Republicans wouldn't allow it. But the way the deal shaped up was that the Democrats would take a hit on entitlements, the Republicans would take a hit on what? Defense spending? Why not taxes? But apparently that just couldn't be. So I think it's setting up this commission, I think, for failure, this defense issue alone.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this Friday about the week in the news, and it's been a big week. We're joined this hour by Eleanor Clift of Newsweek and The Daily Beast, Bill McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News, and On Point's Jack Beatty. And let's just take a couple of comments from our Facebook page. The markets care less about debt than they do about growth. This is from R. Chris Troy. Without government spending, we're done. All the tax cuts leading to a doubling of wealth for the uber-wealthy and coffers full of cash for corporations does nothing if that capital is not spent. And from Catherine Riley, I think this week we got to experience firsthand just how out of touch our Congress is from the average working person, willing to throw us all under the bus for their political strategy. Remember the first wave of stimulus spending? Better it would have been to have just doled that out to the voters. Let's take a call now. Welcome to On Point. Richard is calling from Duke Center, Pennsylvania. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Hi, Jackie. Love your program.
Thank you.
I was just wondering, with all these problems and stuff we're having, when are people going to start taking their money out of the bank? I mean, I know it's a scary thing to do, but nothing's being done. I've been laid off for 2.5 years, and they haven't brought nothing to this area where I'm at.
How are you feeling about your long-term employment prospects, Richard?
It doesn't look very good.
What kind of work do you do?
I worked at a furniture factory.
All right. Thank you so much. What about this sense, Eleanor, of, dare we call it, I'm going to say desperation with a small D. I mean, what's the mood?
Well, one number that surfaced this week is that 44% of the unemployed have been unemployed for 6 months or more. So we now have a group of people called the long-term unemployed. And extending unemployment benefits was not part of this deal. Suspending the payroll tax was also not part of this deal, and that's brought people, some pocketbook relief for the this year, but that expires the end of this year. And I think, again, people are looking to Washington, and Washington is acting as though there's really not much they can do. Now, maybe there is some truth to that. There aren't that many tools left, but I don't think they've exhausted them all. And I think when you hear this gentleman's tone, there's a tone of resignation. I mean, it's not the can-do American spirit that elected Barack Obama and that has been a core of this country's strength for so long. And I think, you know, the politicians really have to step up here. And going off on vacation for 5 weeks was really a bad move by Congress. I'm glad they resolved the FAA stalemate. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, they didn't even have to come back to town. That was just a couple of maneuvers by the leadership. It shows that they can perform when the gun is really to their head.
Here's another number that just pulled off our newscast. Economist Hugh Johnson, 300,000 new jobs would have to be created each month for 5 years to bring it down to 5%. Pretty sobering. Bill McKenzie?
Go ahead.
I was just wondering what you're hearing in Texas.
Well, you know, I think what would help, and this is a longer-term answer, it doesn't get to Richard directly in Pennsylvania, I concede that, but business keeps saying it wants some certainty and some clarity from Washington, particularly when it comes to taxes. And I think they reform the tax code where we make it, you know, you hear the economists talk about it, more efficient, which means fewer deductions, fewer loopholes, collapse some rates, lower some rates. So we have fewer rates at lower percentage points, and then, you know, we can also hope we can grow some revenues through that, which will help with the deficit. But I think that is kind of – that's a sort of reform that Congress can really do that can give business a little bit more certainty so they can go out and start creating more of the jobs that we need over the long term. And I – you know, Eleanor brought up trade pacts, and I agree that we need to do some on Panama and some of the other – you know, a little bit more minor trade pacts that Congress is considering. They're tied up with some debates over how much would favor labor, and I won't go into those details. But, you know, I'd like to see them work those out. They can help. Some regulatory changes could help. But I think the real long-term answers are going to be coming in terms of tax reform as well as getting our debt under control, because our economy can't grow as long as we're having to deal with a $14 trillion debt, which is only going to keep getting bigger.
Mm. I'm speaking with Danielle, who's calling from Woodward, Iowa. Welcome to On Point, Danielle.
Thank you for taking my call, Jackie. My husband and I are lefty liberals who pulled a big chunk of change out of the stock market a couple of weeks ago because we saw this coming. We are really disappointed that the stock market is now based on greed and gambling. We would love to invest our money in American workers, American products, American innovation, and it doesn't seem like the stock market is that place for us. Further, we have a worry that China is buying up a lot of farmland around the world, and I don't think that's on anyone's radar. I'd love to hear your panel's take on that.
Well, thank you for that call from Iowa and from your corner of the world. Jack Beatty, I do want to ask certainly about Danielle's concerns about China and farmland, but I also want to ask about pressures on the middle class in general.
Well, they couldn't be worse. I mean, we're coming off a decade when there's been practically no growth in real income for middle class people, and now we're in a recessionary economy, and the tax reform. Yes, we would like tax reform, but of course one of the issues in tax reform is the mortgage interest deduction, and unless that's handled the right way, that could be a blow at the middle class. It could actually hamper middle class people from buying the house that they need. In short, the American middle class, I think, is in just a terrible position, and the entire dialogue has shifted away from the things that made the middle class strong in the past. Investment, for example, in infrastructure, in education, in research. Those are the things upon which the broad prosperity of America was founded. Investment is now a bad word. The Tea Party, the Republican Party, has made investment a bad word. Well, all business knows you have to invest to grow, but that is not on our agenda now, and the president seems to have acceded to that.
Let me ask you about a really different sort of investment. Danielle mentioned fears of the Chinese buying up farmland in her state. I'm a Midwesterner myself. You know, there was quite an embrace by Wisconsin farmers to grow ginseng for the Chinese market. I mean, are we seeing concerns, if you will, about basically losing control of
of American staples like land.
Gosh, that's I am so I'm so far out of that discussion. It sounds pretty scary to me. I mean, I remember a few years ago, people were worried about the Japanese buying Rockefeller Center. So.
Well, and there was a lot of hype during the election about, you know, the influence of Asian markets. So anyway, this is something the caller expressed. Eleanor?
Well, growing ginseng for the Chinese market, I think, is terrific because that's
they were very
good,
happy with
that's
it.
A good export. I think that's perfectly within American values. But as we go forward, we're in a competition with the Chinese and with India, with these emerging economies, you know, for resources around the world, for markets around the world. And I think the president and others are concerned that we're losing that race because, you know, they're doing better in terms of investments in infrastructure and that sort of thing. They have more. China certainly has a command and control economy. They make a decision and they just do it. We obviously don't have that in this country. But, you know, China has, I think, 600 million people still without electricity. I mean, the scale of their problems dwarfs ours in many ways. But I think the president and other politicians really have to get back to the point where they help instill confidence in the American people, in our system of government. I think there's a feeling now that things aren't working. And if you lose confidence, we go back to FDR. I mean, he had very high unemployment levels and he cut them in half, and then he made some of the same mistakes that we're seeing today of sort of letting up on the gas, mm-hmm. and unemployment shot back up. But people had confidence in his leadership, and I think we don't see confidence right now.
Well, let me go back even more recently. You know, in 1979, I was thinking about this earlier today. You know, we were really things were bleak, and I bought into the bleakness, you know, when we had stagflation, mm-hmm. Combination of high unemployment, high inflation, and things just didn't look like they're going to turn around. And, you know, Reagan came in and restored confidence, and I concede he did it in part through using a credit card, which ran up our debt, which we're now dealing with today. And I also say I worked for John Anderson in 1980, so I wasn't there to elect Reagan. But Reagan did restore confidence, and we had a pretty good run there for at least a couple of decades, maybe 25 years. And so, you know, this doesn't directly speak to the woman in Iowa or to Richard in Pennsylvania, but if you think over the long term, you know, we do get these periods where things look pretty hopeless, and throughout our history, we have had a capacity to rebound. And I'm not sure I know exactly what the rebound is going to look like, but, you know, I don't think we should lose all hope that we are, that, you know, we're going to start pulling our money out of banks. You look even 3 years ago when things were really going, or the economy was tanking. Well, you know, the economy, the stock market kind of recouped its losses and kept on going.
Well, we can quote Churchill, keep calm and carry on. I think that was Churchill.
Sounds good.
Sounds like Barack Obama.
Let's turn to where the GOP presidential candidates and possible candidates could be. Speaking of thinking about attitudes, this is something that affects your governor in Texas, Rick Perry, mm-hmm. the longest running governor now, right now in the United States. Yes? Longest term in office?
I believe so.
He 14, has yep. How many weeks? How many months?
Well, if he serves out this term, it will be 14 years.
14 years. Well, Governor Perry has invited Americans to take part in a controversial event called The Response, a national day of fasting and prayer. It's scheduled for tomorrow in Houston's Reliant Stadium. Let's just hear a clip from that.
As an elected leader, I'm all too aware of government's limitations when it comes to fixing things that are spiritual in nature. That's where prayer comes in, and we need it more than ever. With the economy in trouble, communities in crisis, and people adrift in a sea of moral relativism, we need God's help. That's why I'm calling on Americans to pray and fast like Jesus did, and as God called the Israelites to do in the book of Joel.
So what would Jesus do? Bill McKenzie, I don't know if that's going to help Danielle or Richard, but this has been a very controversial move and perhaps would be getting even more attention if the markets were not where they are today. I mean, what are people saying about this?
You're talking about the prayer rally.
Yes, it's called the response. Yeah.
Well, you know, I wrote a column this week saying, I think, you know, look, the guy can hold a prayer rally. So this cut him some slack. He got sued over it by a group that said he shouldn't be able to attend. It's sponsored by the American Family Association. It is specifically a Christian event. We editorialized that wishing, you know, it would be a broader base thing. I tell you what bothers me about this the most, and I'll get to your question, what do people in Texas feel about it? I think what bothers me most is there's a real danger, or there's a troubling mixture when you are trying to marry up the flag with the cross. And that's different from involving religion and politics in some way where people, you know, may politicians may invoke God to bless the United States at the end of their speeches. And I am not arguing about the divorce from religion from politics, but in this particular event, I think that we are getting a little too close to God being on our side. That's point number one. Point number two, I would argue to Perry's theology is, look, you know, we need to pray to God help to fix these things. Absolutely, let's do that's fine. But God gives us the tools, the ability to reason, to create. C.S. Lewis wrote about this, to write, so, you know, I think God expects us to be involved in fixing our own problems. So I don't think we should just wait for a bolt of lightning. I think what it's seen in Texas, there are certainly people who would be quite willing to participate in the rally. I think there are also those who would see this as a political move by the governor. He is, in my book at least, you know, very likely to get in this race. In fact, I bet he gets in the race. I'd be stunned if he doesn't. And so this is a setup going into the race with him being able to court social and religious conservatives.
Yeah, I take that, but it's also a double-edged sword, isn't it, Bill? I mean, some of the people, the endorsers of this response, this prayer day, one man, one of the endorsers, spoke of gay Americans as domestic terrorists. Another one called the Statue of Liberty a demonic idol. Another one blamed the bird deaths in Arkansas on the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. John Hagee, who was too hot for John McCain, he's another one of the endorsers of this prayer meeting. He said that Hitler was sent by God to hunt Jews, and he called the Roman Catholic Church the whore of Babylon. This may help Mr. Perry with very conservative voters in Iowa, but isn't this just a sort of self-inflicted wound? Should he ever become the Republican nominee because of the kinds of people he's consorting with here?
Go ahead. Yeah, please.
Well,
Bill?
I would say yes. But, you know, if we dial it back to 08 when Barack Obama had his Jeremiah Wright issue that he had to deal with. So, you know, it isn't unique to Perry. But yes, I think Perry is going to have to figure out how to deal with this issue once he gets beyond Iowa or any other of the early Republican primaries like South Carolina to figure out, you know, if this issue is still alive, how he put some distance between himself and the comments you just made.
Does it make him a more viable candidate, do you think, Eleanor?
It makes him a more viable candidate in the short term. He can win Iowa. I don't necessarily see that he would do that well in New Hampshire, and Jack would know better than I. But South Carolina, one of the early states, also very receptive to the kind of, you know, mixture of Christian religion with conservative social values, he could do well there. I still think he's a regional candidate, and I don't see that he would necessarily go the distance. But he seems that Republicans are looking at their field, and they're not happy, and they're focusing right now on Governor Perry and whether he'll get in. And if Bill's right, looks like he could get in.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, Congresswoman Gabby Giffords returned to the House floor to cast a yes vote for the debt deal. She was greeted with a standing ovation. Here's a friend and colleague, Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
She proved her determination is as fierce as we all knew it was, and it was absolutely electrifying.
A new government mandate axed copays for contraceptives. Supporters say it will improve access to contraceptives for women.
It is very, very expensive, and I think that that's one of the problems, especially for younger women who really can't afford it.
36 million pounds of ground turkey have been recalled in a nationwide salmonella scare. Here's advice from Sacramento County public health official Glenna Trochet.
If you don't see any red, you know that you're thoroughly cooked. It should be brown, or as my husband says, it should be shoe, like the sole of a shoe.
We're joined today by Bill McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News, Eleanor Clift of Newsweek, and On Point's Jack Beattie. And we were speaking just before the break about how the Republican candidates line up. And we were speaking with you, Eleanor Clift. And that wasn't the only news about Governor Perry from Texas this week. Also, there was a front page piece about education in Texas and what he has had to say about higher education there, which got a lot of scrutiny.
Yes. I mean, he apparently sees a big idea as a possible entry into the presidential race of going after institutions of higher learning, public institutions, challenging them to produce a bachelor's degree that would cost a total of $10,000, and also more closely scrutinizing academics to make sure that their worth in profit-making terms the investment in them. It's a different way of measuring higher education, and I think it would have sort of a conservative populist appeal because populists don't like the elites, and I think there is certainly a feeling that the cost of higher education has gotten out of reach. What struck me, though, is it's just so different from the appeal that George W. Bush had coming out of Texas. He wanted to reform lower education, and he was the compassionate conservative, and it was such a difference from a party who, in the cycle before, wanted to eliminate the Department of Education. So George W. Bush made his mark as a moderate and a compassionate conservative, and now Rick Perry, Governor Perry, is coming at it from the other side in a very different political time, and it could be very appealing because at least it is a big idea, and I can't say that I look at the other members of the Republican field and that I can't identify a big idea with any one of them, and so I think Governor Perry thinks he would be the alternative to Mitt Romney, who is still the front runner, although a very weak front runner.
And I think he has put his finger, Perry's put his finger on something. I mean, I think there are a lot of people who are concerned about inefficiencies in higher education and seeing the cost of the tuition going up. Either they're paying it or they're paying it for their kids. This whole thing is called the Seven Breakthrough Solutions, and it's started by a guy who did teach the University of Texas, and he no longer teaches there. And his thing is that teachers should teach more, professors should teach more, worry less about research. To some extent, he's right. We need high-priced professors teaching more, and that is important. I won't go into detail, but some of his ideas are very legitimate. On the other hand, these universities like UT and others, they are very important to the economies of their state because they are research-based institutions. What's been interesting politically about this with Perry is he's gotten a lot of pushback from the business community in Texas over some of his higher education ideas. And there's a group that has formed involving a lot of business folks, some Bush Republicans who have been speaking out against what he's trying to do, and it all gets the details about who he appoints to be on the Board of Regents at the University of Texas, as well as Texas A&M, our two flagship schools. It's a big deal in Texas, and I just think it has been very interesting to see the pushback he's gotten from business on it. And I think Eleanor's right. There is a difference here between Bush and Perry, Bush being very pro public education, Perry kind of not. I'm not saying he's anti-public education because that's not the case. And I could point you to some things he's done in a positive way there, but he is not running on an education platform the way Bush did.
Well, putting pressure on the universities also plays into the theme that academia is filled with the hotbed of liberals, and it's a way to cast that as the conservative populism against the academic liberal elites.
Mm. Well, I'll be watching the Iowa straw poll, which I think is the 15th of August, and see how the Republican candidates stack up. The president is going to be speaking a little later this hour, the top of the hour, to veterans about job growth. In the wake of Congress's debt deal on Tuesday, he vowed to focus his attention on unemployment and jobs. Let's listen to a clip.
And in the coming months, I'll continue also to fight for what the American people care most about. New jobs, higher wages, and faster economic growth.
Jack Beatty, do you think he can successfully turn around the public debate and make it about jobs?
No, I don't. I think he's already ceded that public debate to the Tea Party and to the Republicans. The debate is about, or at least the policy now, is all shaped around the premise that what we're suffering from is debt and deficit, not slow growth. You know, Jake Tapper of ABC News asked Jake Carney, the press secretary, a tough question yesterday. He said, other than calling on Congress to pass things you've been calling on Congress to pass for months, what is the president doing to help the economy? I don't see anything that he's doing to help the economy. I think that he's trying to get political positioning here and to say, I'm saying the right things about the economy. But would he, for example, send a jobs bill to Congress? Would he, in the certainty that they would veto it, but to set up a record for the 2012 election, a Harry Truman-like run against the do-nothing Congress? Is he going to do that? I very much doubt it. I think he thinks he can find some way to compromise with the Congress. Compromise. They wouldn't even agree to, the Republicans wouldn't even agree to extend the payroll tax cut for next year because it would stimulate the economy, which in their view helps the president. They don't want to do anything that helps him. So I really think other than lip service, he's out of ammunition and he's out of gas.
Eleanor, it doesn't seem as if he is being, shall we say, punished in the polls quite as much as some members of Congress and the Republican Party. His approval rating seems to be holding at around 47%. But let's take Jack's point. If he can't deliver what he has been saying he's going to deliver in jobs, would his numbers decrease? Does this put the White House in a weaker position? It was interesting, too, yesterday how Jack mentioned Jake Tapper, that they did sort of tussle, he and Jake Carney, over whether or not we were entering another recession, a double-dip recession.
Well, I think the president needs to be more out front with the things that he is trying to do. For example, in this speech at the Navy Yard, I think it is, he will be unveiling a proposal for tax credits for businesses who hire veterans and a double tax credit for businesses that hire wounded veterans. Now, presumably he's going to send that to Capitol Hill because he needs their approval. He ought to take that and he ought to take several other things. And it seems to me Congress would have a hard time. They love tax credits and they love veterans. So wouldn't that be a natural? So put it out there. And if they refuse, really isolate them, shame them. Do like everybody did when they went home and didn't settle the FAA problem. So I think he's just got to shine the light on where the problem is and so that the American people know that he's on their side. I think right now he seems a little bit too diffident, too intellectual about it. And I know, people are always saying, well, Bill Clinton was so good because he could feel your pain. Barack Obama is a different kind of personality, but he's got to use the strengths that he has to better connect with the American people.
Bill McKenzie, you advised a presidential candidate once back in 1980, John Anderson. Are you quite as pessimistic as Jack is about his ability to move the jobs front? And how do you think this will play publicly?
Well, I think that the better course is for him to focus on the debt. And I'm going to be a hybrid here. Yes, go out and talk about these things with the tax credits for veterans. Go out and talk about trying to get some trade deals done. But the fact is, those in and of themselves are not going to drive the job numbers back down to 7% or something like that. I'd point to what's going on in the UK, you know, where, and I can see David Cameron is having problems trying to get some of his ideas passed. But both in the UK and Germany, leaders there, more center-right leaders, have gone tried to tackle the debt. And if you recall, about over the last year or so, Obama was trying to get them to invest more, to spend more, to try to pump up their economies. And they said, no, we're not. We're going to focus on the debt. And I just think that if Obama can have a hybrid plan here where he talks about some smaller bore things while focusing on this grand bargain that we, you know, I keep bringing up, I think that's the way forward. And I think that's the way for him to win the independence that he's going to need to win reelection. And more important than his reelection, I think that's the way we start to generate the jobs and economic growth that we're finally is going to move us forward.
We didn't talk a great deal about the FAA dispute that got resolved, at least temporarily, yesterday. Let's take a call from John, who's calling from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Welcome to On Point, John.
Yes. So as I understand the situation, for the last 2 weeks, the money that was supposed to go to the FAA didn't go to the FAA. $30 million bucks a day for 2 weeks is $420 million. It would seem to me that that money probably was collected and went into somebody's pocket, probably the airline. And I think that's a really strong motivation not to resolve the situation.
Let's. Do you think that the president can move the whole discussion forward? We've just been talking about the president's response to this. What do you think, John?
I'm commenting on the American public's lack of confidence in the integrity of Congress. And this is just a case in point. If you can't trust our elected officials to do the right thing, instead have some kind of an arrangement with the airlines in this case, so that they pocket $420 million, that's just another reason not to trust Congress.
Okay. Thank you, John. Eleanor, what did you make of Ray LaHood's handling of this, the transportation secretary?
Oh, I think Ray LaHood, who is a former Republican congressman from Illinois, and he and then-Senator Barack Obama, you know, bonded when they were in the Congress together. I think Ray LaHood is an excellent spokesman. He has kind of a working man's appeal, and he just went right to it. And he helped force the issue this last week, and I think he... The president needs more spokesmen like Ray LaHood. I think he's someone who definitely connects.
Jack Beatty?
Well, you know, the background to this, as NPR reported last night, the key to this, the whole dispute, has been issues of union organizing in the airline industry. There was a rule, the 76-year-old rule, that essentially counted people who... eligible voters who don't vote in elections as no voters. That was changed by President Obama's National Mediation Board. The Republicans changed it back to non-voters, people who are eligible who don't vote. That should be counted as a no vote. Who is behind this? According to NPR, big push from Delta Airlines, which is non-unionized, through a major Washington lobbying group led by Trent Lott and John Breaux. And they have put on a big pressure with big push with Republican lawmakers to get essentially to keep this, to change this law from what it was for the National Mediation Board to what it is now, seems to be in the air. So again, to the point of our caller, this is exactly the sort of thing he's talking about, the influence of lobbyists on policy.
Bill McKibben?
Yes, the larger ideological issues, with the Republicans wanting to, you know, strip some worker rights, and the Democrats wanting to protect labor rights, and that plays out in even this minor, what should have been a minor confrontation, has these big ideological overtones.
Bill McKenzie, well, I don't want to leave.
Please,
Bill, go ahead.
Well, the only thing I would add is, and I'm not an expert on this issue, is the longer-term profitability of the airlines. And so, you know, I can see from the airlines' perspective, they are looking at their bottom line. American, based in Fort Worth, you know, has gone a long period without making a whole lot of money. So I can see how they are concerned. Having said that, this is the type of issue Congress, the Senate particularly, shouldn't have left town without resolving, because this affects real people, where they live, all of us. I'm flying tomorrow. I'm glad to see it resolved. And, you know, I don't know, no matter what the issues are, you stay there until you resolve it. I'm glad through, you know, something could happen.
Let's just take a couple of minutes. I don't want to entirely close out our hour without looking at the Middle East. We've seen some extraordinary things there this week. Hosni Mubarak on trial, and also the shelling of Hama by the regime of Bashar al-Assad. Is the U.S., do you think, able to do any more than it has already done in terms of denouncing this? Anything that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton can do, Eleanor?
I don't think we have any influence, with Syria, and it appears that the other players in the region don't either. And I must say, the imagery watching Mubarak, I obviously didn't live under that regime. I might feel differently, but he did some good things from the U.S. perspective for a long time, protecting that peace treaty. But going forward, for the people who want to govern Egypt, I think they've really got to be careful about crossing the line into retribution and revenge, and try to uphold the factors of a civil society and a judicial system that they're trying to create. It's a fragile time for that democracy going forward, if it is going to be a democracy.
Well, thank you very much to everyone for participating today. Eleanor Clift is a contributing editor for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, and she joined us from Washington, as did Bill McKenzie. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News. Thank you both for being with us. And Jack,
thank you.
Jack, I'm not forgetting you. Thank you for being with us from Hanover, New Hampshire.
Pleasure to be with you.
It's been a really good discussion. Have a good weekend, everyone. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. He's back on Monday, and this is On Point.